One way that you might identify yourself generationally is through the legal TV shows that you're familiar with. So if you looked forward to new episodes of Perry Mason, that likely says that you might be a certain age. Or maybe you couldn't wait to solve new crimes with Matlock, or to catch laughs at night court. Or if you followed the exploits of Ally McBeal, or The Practice, or if you gravitated toward JAG, or The Good Fight, or Better Call Saul. Someone who's knowledgeable about TV would maybe be able to guess your age roughly based on your particular memories and interests as it comes to legal shows. But of course, one unifying factor amidst all of those shows for legal show lovers is none other than Law and Order, right? Been on in one incarnation or another for over 30 years now. That was actually a show that Kim and I liked to watch early on in our relationship. Eventually we stopped though because the little dun-dun chime between scenes became a little much for us, so we moved on to other things. But what is it that draws people to legal shows? I mean, you could talk about the sensational cases. You could talk about the compelling personalities of the attorneys and the judges and the criminals or alleged criminals. We could also talk about, I think, our kind of love-hate relationship with the law. On the one hand, we love it. We need it. We need law. We want order. It would be chaos without it. We love it. On the other hand, sometimes we hate it. I mean, particularly if laws frustrate us, if they trip us up, if they're misapplied, if they seem unreasonable or unfair, if they have unintended consequences, we hate them. So, our love-hate relationship with the law, I would contend, has kept us watching law on the screen. And the people who make it and break it and keep it and apply it. And we've done that now for decades. Well, you know, the Bible also deals with issues of law and order. The first five books of our Bible, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, are the Pentateuch, and they're called by some the book of the law because they convey God's laws given to the Jewish people. And they received the laws and they struggled with the law. And you can continue down the timeline of history, and Christians struggle with the idea of law. And the Christian story adds an interesting twist on the struggle with law. Because when we talk about the Christian faith, we're also talking about grace. And we've defined grace in past weeks as any expression of love shown to us in our need without our earning it. And so the question is, how do grace and law come together? If grace is all about what we don't deserve, and law is about what you do deserve and getting what you deserve, particularly if you do wrong, how do those two things coincide? Maybe a more specific question is how can God give us laws and at the same time show us grace? How could he expect us to follow any law that he gives if he's only going to show us grace when we don't follow it? Important questions for us this morning. And so we're in the second week of a series called The Grace Chase, where we're trying to understand and wrestle through what does it mean to experience grace? What does it mean to pursue grace? What does it mean when God's grace pursues us? And this morning I want to look at really the pinnacle in many respects of law, and that is the Ten Commandments. They are well known throughout the world and are viewed by many, at least in Western civilization, as a keystone of the idea of law. But you know, when we talk about the Ten Commandments, they're often kind of plucked out of the air. without background or context or even necessarily much knowledge of what they are or why they matter. In a book that he wrote on grace, Andy Stanley shares a story about a dry cleaning outfit that he went to at one point. And the woman who always manned the station there was a woman named Agnes. And so Andy would occasionally try to engage her in some kind of spiritual conversation. And her response any time the conversation went there was, "Well, I keep the Ten Commandments." And that was kind of her way of subtly or not so subtly ending the conversation that she didn't want to have. So one time Andy asks her, "Well, do you know all of the Ten Commandments?" And she said, "No, but I keep them." Well, we want to try a different approach this morning. We want to actually look at them, and we're not going to look at all of them in depth, but I want to look at them together and see what they have to say to us. And so I'd invite you to turn with me to Exodus chapter 20. That's where we're going to find them this morning. We want to look at them in context, and we want to see their place and their purpose, and especially how they relate to grace. We begin to see this as we look at them, and I'll give you kind of a preview of where we're going to go as we read the Ten Commandments. God's law, encapsulated in these ten, is actually an expression of his amazing grace. His law is an expression of his grace. See, the law was a part of the grander story of God's work in the world and among people. It really has its birth back in Genesis, the second half of Genesis, as we find God working with a particular family, the family of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, who would later be called Israel, and then Israel's family that ends up traveling from the area that God has given them to Egypt during a famine. His family goes to Egypt, and there they grow from about a network of 70 related people to a nation, really. 3 million people. And over that time, as they grow, the Egyptians start to get a little nervous. And so the Pharaoh and his army enslaves the people. Altogether, the people of Israel are in Egypt for about 430 years, and for most of that time, they were slaves. Probably for longer than the United States has been a nation, Israel was in slavery in Egypt. And the big story of Exodus, the second book of the Bible, that's where we're looking this morning, is the story of how God used Moses to bring the Israelites out of slavery in Egypt. To put in context what we're going to read, the people have come out of slavery in Egypt. God has led them across the Red Sea into the desert to the foot of Mount Sinai. And at this point, they're basically just a big collection of people. I mean, they have been in slavery for hundreds of years. So they have little, we talk about the nation of Israel, they have little sense of national identity, little awareness, maybe even limited or distorted knowledge of God, the God who has brought them out of slavery. And so God gives them a law at Mount Sinai. In fact, he gives them not 10 laws or 20 laws, he gives them 613 laws that are encapsulated for us in these first five books of the Bible. And these laws pertain to property, and they pertain to economics and diet and sanitation and marriage and children and their forms of worship. It covers everything. If you've ever read the third book of the Bible, Leviticus, you might know that Leviticus is the place where Bible reading plans go to die. Because it's the laws. And it is so boring. And it is confusing. And you wonder, why is it here? And why are there so many details? And do we really need to know, you know, about mildew? And, you know, all of these little things that seem unimportant to us. But I remind you, who received the law? People, this large group of people that had no government. They had no judiciary. They had no king. They had been surrounded and controlled, likely indoctrinated by the Egyptians for centuries. And so they need guidance. I mean, they had Moses, and they had a pillar of fire by day and a pillar of cloud by day and a pillar of fire by night. But they needed more than that. They needed to know how to conduct themselves as a free people. And so they were given the law, and the Ten Commandments that we're about to read were the first laws given, and kind of the summary of what would follow, and they set the tone for everything else beyond. We're going to take this in a couple chunks. Let's read the first couple verses. Exodus 20. It says, "And God spoke all these words, 'I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery.'" Pause there. We're not getting far fast, are we? What I want you to notice here, before we get into the rules, is that with God, a relationship comes before the rules. The relationship comes before the rules. "I am the Lord your God," he says. If he's your God, if he's their God, that implies relationship. Up to this point, they had not done anything to deserve or establish a relationship with God. I mean, they really couldn't do anything. They were in slavery before this. They were on the run. They had nothing to offer. They didn't even know how to please God. They didn't know what he wanted for them or what he wanted from them. And into that mess, God steps with grace. He comes with grace, and he gives them what they need that they couldn't earn. And he frees them, and he welcomes them into relationship, all before any laws are given. And you know, it just makes sense that he operates that way. I mean, really, all of the most significant relationships in our lives operate that way. Parents welcome children into their lives. And, you know, they don't start by pulling out the rule sheet and say, "Now, if you follow all of these rules, you're going to be my kid." Right? Maybe you wish you could do that sometimes. Have auditions or something. Or, you know, even more basic than that, think about a pet. You know, we have a dog and a cat in our house. And we were not able, before they came to our house, to have the, you know, like, "Are you going to listen to everything we say?" discussion. You know, here are the things that you are allowed to do and not do. Do you agree to this? Then come be our pet. You know, we don't do that. I mean, the relationship comes first. And then when you're in relationship, then you start to work on the rules. Then you work on what is good and wise and how to live together. And God relates to us the same way. And he starts with relationship. He started that way with Israel. He starts that way with us. He invites us into relationship without preconditions, without requiring us to get our act together first, without requiring us to measure up to some standard first. He invites us, he embraces us as we are. And if we will come, if we will recognize our need, if we will acknowledge our need and our inability to live for anyone other than ourselves, if we will start there, in that simple act, we can begin a relationship with our Creator. And now things will change from there as the relationship grows, expectations grow, but as they do, we have God's Spirit inside of us to help us rise to the challenge, but it all starts the desire to respond to God's gift of grace and the offer of relationship that he extends to us. It starts there. Then we get into rules. Pick it up at verse 3. "You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself an image in the form of anything in heaven above or on the earth beneath or in the waters below. You shall not bow down to them or worship them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, punishing the children for the sin of the parents to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing love to 1,000 generations of those who love me and keep my commandments. You shall not misuse the name of the Lord your God, for the Lord will not hold anyone guiltless who misuses his name. Remember the Sabbath day by keeping it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work, neither you nor your son or daughter, nor your male or female servant, nor your animals, nor any foreigner residing in your towns. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, the sea and all that is in them. But he rested on the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy. Pause there again. So, relationship precedes rules. But what we find as we begin to dig into the rules is that the rules confirm and protect the relationship. They confirm and protect the relationship. So let's just do a quick walkthrough of the four that we've looked at here. Verse 3, you shall have no other gods before me, God says. What he's saying is, I want to be your one and only God. And I want you to trust me completely for your every need. Now, this was a foreign idea in that world. It was a time and a day where everybody else, every other culture had multiple gods. They had gods based on natural forces and functions in many cases. So, sun and moon, rain and harvest, fertility, birth and death. Different gods for different needs and seasons and situations. And into that, God says, I want you to see, I'm the one. I am your all-sufficient source and supply of anything you need. I am the one. Then we get to the second one. He says, not only are the Israelites not to seek other gods, but they're not to create an image of another god, a monument, a statue, any other kind of image that would represent God. And as mind-bending to them as the idea of having one God and not a multiplicity was, here's another mind-bender for them. This God is invisible, and you don't make an image of him. See, other nations could usually see some kind of representation of their God. So, I mean, they could look at the sun or the moon, or they would craft, using their skill, some kind of statue, some kind of image that would represent that God. And then they would bow and pray to that image and bring food or clothing or do all of those kinds of things with the image. And God says, no pictures. No statues, no representations of me. Because, I mean, after all, how can you take the infinite, the omnipotent, the majestic, and, you know, somehow cram it into some little statue made of wood or stone? He also didn't want them treating him like an inanimate object, something they could manipulate or control, that they could visit and then leave behind, that they could, you know, choose to pay attention to or to ignore. His driving point was, I am your God. There's no one and nothing like me. And you are my people. And then we come to the third one, verse 7. And we take it a step further. And he says, I don't want you to take my name in vain. Now, today, we tend to view that as a command to, you know, watch what you say if you hit your finger with a hammer, right? But the clearest sense of what he means is, don't misuse God's name by trying to further your own agenda with that name. And don't misuse the name by trying to connect God to something that does not honor him. Of course, as with all of these commands, People have been very inventive over the years about how to break them. Christian history is littered with examples of people tying things to God that he would never want. From the Crusades against Muslims in the Middle Ages, to the Nazis' reign of terror during World War II, to ethnic cleansing and terrorism and political violence, to more personal stories of churches or religious leaders abusing their authority. Lots of things done in God's name, and yet very early on, God said, don't do that. And then we have the last of the four, these first four, and that is the Sabbath law. This divinely appointed day off for the Israelites, grounded in the creation story. God rested after 6 days of creation, according to Genesis 1. And here he makes the point that he can provide for his people for 7 days on 6 days of work. And so he offers them rest as they rely upon him. You take all of these four together, and what you find is this confirmation of the relationship that God has invited his people into. He is their God. There is no other. These are his people. They worship him alone, even though they can't see him. These people honor his name, these people for whom he provides. It confirms the relationship. The rules will protect the relationship. It will keep them from being sidetracked in their relationship with him, from turning to false gods or relying on themselves instead of him. But then the law goes on. Let's look at the last few. Verse 12. Honor your father and your mother so that you may live long in the land the Lord your God is giving you. You shall not murder. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. You shall not give false testimony against your neighbor. You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife or his male or female servant, his ox or donkey, or anything that belongs to your neighbor. If we were to kind of sum up those last six, it's really God teaching the Israelites now how to honor one another. And that's important for them. Remember, they're coming out of slavery, and slavery has a way of dehumanizing people. And so they need to be humanized. They need to know how to relate to each other. And so they learn that starts with honoring parents and family, and honoring others' bodies, and honoring others' marriages, and others' belongings, and others' reputations. Honor each other. And if they will do that, then it will protect their relationships in freedom with one another. Because you know, as well as I do, that in a broken, me-first world, we don't naturally do that. We don't naturally honor everybody else. And so God's law was intended to train these people in ways to do that. And God's desire was that the surrounding nations would be able to see this nation of Israel, and they would be astonished. And they would be attracted to this group of people that in a remarkable way elevated the status of everyone who was part of their community. This group of people who built a thriving nation based on loving and trusting and submitting to the divine lawgiver. This was part of God's intent. This gift of grace given to Israel with the hope that they would also be a gift to the world. A society rescued from slavery, built in relationship securely with God, with unheard of freedoms in relationships with each other. Beautiful picture. And also, it never quite happened that way, did it? If only it had worked. But of course, they didn't stick to it. They didn't follow very well. Philip Yancey comments that as you read the history of the Israelites, what you find is that the law did not encourage obedience. In fact, in some ways, it magnified disobedience. And it even had a way of putting new ideas into people's heads about how to break the law, about how not to follow. But you know, even in the failure, there was grace. Because God, being God and all, knew that they would fail. He saw the end from the beginning. And so what he did is he used the law to uncover their need for a savior. They needed a hero. They needed someone who could come and keep the law perfectly, and who in his perfection and power could absorb into himself every failure to keep the law, and who could offer forgiveness and a new relationship that exceeded the law. Any guesses who that might be? Jesus, of course. He was the one, the embodiment of grace, perfectly fulfilling the law. So that's law and order and grace back then. What about now? I mean, what do we do? What do we do with the 10 and the 513 that come after? What do we do with them? Well, some of them end up being restated in the New Testament as encouragement for Christians and how to relate to God and to one another. So they have a way of coming back. Some of them actually have been adapted into the laws of modern nations. And so we find some of them binding on us in how we live today. Others, you know, are not part of our modern law codes. They're not necessarily stated expectations for Christians. But there's wise principles. There's kernels of truth in them that we are wise to learn from and to find ways to live out without them being do or die rules. So I would make the case that as for the Israelites, these laws also show us that we need God's grace. We need God's grace. People on their own have never consistently been able to keep the law of any kind. I mean, we can't even keep our own laws. When our kids were young, we had to institute a particular rule at the dinner table. It was a no singing rule. No singing while we're eating dinner. And it was a good rule, you know. I mean, you know, trying to keep your children from choking is usually a good idea. So we had this rule, but occasionally Kim or I would, you know, inspiration would strike and we violated our own rule and we'd sing a line at the table. And our kids were very pleased to point out, "You sang at the table." Can't even keep our own rules, much less any other rules. Even the best of us fails the most basic standards. We need God's grace. And as an expression of his grace, we need the Savior he has offered to us, who has kept the law perfectly for us, who frees us from our inability to keep it. and gives us his own spirit to help us grow into the kind of people who want to keep it. It shows us that we need God's grace. And it shows us ways to respond to God's grace. These laws, even laws that aren't binding on us, show us ways, as we understand them and reflect on them and talk about them, show us ways to respond to grace. Because they tell us what God is like. And they tell us about the kind of life that he desires for us. And though we're not bound by the all 613 practices, we can seek to understand the wisdom that's there. And then we can seek to live it. Not to make God love us, because he already does. But out of gratitude for the God of every grace, who pours out his grace on us and gives us just what we need, and sometimes just what we need is a law, is guidance, gives us just what we need. And out of gratitude, we can respond and live it. We need law, and we need order, and we most certainly need grace. And in his grace, God offers us all that we need. Never because we deserve it, but because it's his joy and his love and his character to give it. And we can receive. Would you pray with me? We thank you, O God, for every gift of grace. And sometimes those gifts are not the things that we want, but the things that we need. And so we thank you for a law, for rules that show us just how much we need you, how much we need your mercy, how much we need your forgiveness. And thank you for the forgiveness that you have offered us. Thank you for the mercy you have shown us as we realize that need. And would you work in our lives in such a way, oh God, every one of us, that we become more and more of the people that you want us to be. Not rule followers, but people who naturally live out of the grace you have shown, live out of the mercy you've shown, living lives of love that honor you and each other. And we give you thanks for how you have shown that to us most fully in Jesus Christ. And it's in his mercy and in his beautiful, powerful, wonderful name that we pray.